This is a matter of David Miner v. Beverly Hastings et al. Mr. Sanders.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Stephen G. Sanders, on behalf of the appellant David Miner, with me at council table is Annie Carrot. We're from the Gibbons firm in Newark. The Court, please, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
We ask the Court to reverse the order denying habeas relief for two independent reasons. The first one is Darden issue, on which this Court initially granted a certificate of appealability. And that issue, as this Court knows from our brief, turns on a misstatement by the prosecutor in summation regarding the burden of proof. And in this case, there was no, absolutely no consideration by the division, the last recent decision of the state court about the strength of the evidence in this case, to measure the prejudicial effect of that argument.
Why would that be necessary? Let's start with what happened. And what happened here was that the use of percentages was first introduced through the testimony of the victim, right?
That's correct.
It is next invoked by trial counsel for Mr. Miner during closing argument. So she is the one who chose to characterize the 80% figure as a low B.
Correct.
Why is that really not invited error? Didn't the prosecutor have to say something in response to that? Something.
Well, the prosecutor has every right to respond to arguments, and let me answer that in two parts. Number one, the appellate division did not find that there was invited error or even fair comment. The appellate division noted that this argument came following the defense argument, but there's been no finding either by the appellate division or even by
Chief. Require finding. If we're looking at this under the AEDPA standard, why wouldn't we need to consider the fact that this was not from the defendant's closing?
Well, and I'll answer both questions at the same time. It's the state court's job to apply Darden, right, reasonably. But in this case, the defense attorney in making that argument didn't say to the jury, reasonable doubt requires 100% certainty. That had been the argument.
Except that there are no cases out there to suggest that 100% certainty is required. And for that matter, there are no cases that I know of that say 80% is not enough. I think the whole introduction, frankly, speaking for myself alone, of percentages to discuss reasonable doubt is has not only dubious value, probably no value. I assume we could agree, just the two of us agree, that the suggestion that 80% is enough for reasonable doubt is a legal issue being introduced here, and that it is incorrect, and therefore what the prosecutor did was make an erroneous statement of law.
Yes.
There's nothing to support 80%. Frankly, intuitively, I doubt that's enough, but that is not a question that I think that we have to resolve here.
Right. But weren't
these percentages, I mean, this was argument. Defense counsel urged X. Opposing counsel urged Y. Clear to the jury that there's an argument about whether these percentages apply, and then the judge gives a very good instruction about what reasonable doubt is and says arguments of the lawyers are not evidence. So
the standard
it's hard to imagine that in and of itself that the judge's instruction is not something that the jury clung to.
Well, Judge Rendell, as we note in our brief, the jury, I don't think, would have known that what the parties were arguing were inconsistent with the judge's instruction. And in a case...
Why? The judge made no mention of percentages whatsoever.
He says you decide for yourself based upon... Yeah.
Right.
Well, but percentages off the table.
The judge did instruct the jury on reasonable doubt. But in this case, with the evidence being as weak as it was, right? And so Darden is a sliding scale, right?
But in the end, it wasn't just 80%, was it? I mean, you had the two separate identifications.
Correct.
So in the end, the government's case is actually factually stronger than the 80% would suggest.
And that's the other answer to your question. That's what the prosecutor should have gone to, which he ultimately did, which is, well, the defense wants you to focus on this 80% at the time of trial, but doesn't that show that the victim is being credible because earlier in time he makes a stronger identification?
But weren't both counsel in their arguments legally incorrect? Because the question was not whether 80% or 95% is enough for reasonable doubt. 80% and or 95% were the figures being placed upon the certainty of the witness himself, which is a factual matter, not a legal question. So what counsel both in their respective ways managed to do was transform what is inherently a factual question into a misstatement of law.
Well, they did do
both
that.
Both of them did.
Both. Well, I don't know that what the defense said is a misstatement of the law. The defense, maybe inartfully, was trying to say this is unreliable evidence. That's reasonable doubt.
Well, but the inartfulness made it a misstatement of law, really.
Well, I'd like to get to the Batson issue as well.
Good.
Because in reviewing this for today and preparing, I became even more troubled as I looked through jury selection, and I probably...
Is there anything in the record about the ultimate racial composition of the veneer?
Of the veneer? No. And I certainly wish that would be in the record, and I certainly wish I was here.
So you can't calculate challenge rate here.
I can't calculate challenge rate, and I wish I were here on an ineffective one as well, because a good defense attorney would continue to keep re-raising the Batson claim as jury selection progresses. And
that's a huge problem here, isn't it?
And obviously would have said more than just 4 out of 5. Would have said, well, this woman said this, and that would mean that she'd probably be more favorable to the government than not, so these make no sense, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And then probably the prima facie case would have been satisfied.
Well, but in a case based on numbers alone, it's obviously better to have the strike rate, the exclusion rate. And
but that's what we're left with, isn't it? I mean, isn't this numbers alone, at least as far as the prima facie case?
No, it's not, Your Honor. It's numbers plus the statement that we quoted in our brief.
That's later. After the fact. Was there objection to that statement?
There wasn't an objection to it, but because the trial court...
It's after the fact.
Yeah.
It's after the fact, but the trial court applied the wrong standard when it found no prima facie case. So the appellate division...
Why? What standard did it apply?
It applied the pre-Johnson
because of the Johnson.
Standard. The pre-Johnson standard of substantial
likelihood.
So the appellate division purported to correct that error. But when the appellate division did that, it didn't just look at what the state of the record at that time. It considered, as it was entitled to do, everything in jury selection. I mean, if the prosecutor had made an outright, blatant, racist statement, even, let's say, in summation, I think that would be fertile ground up on direct appeal for the defense attorney to point to that. So I'm looking at that statement now, a complaint, a gratuitous complaint that the jury is comprised of too many African Americans.
Now, wait a minute. That is not the language. I read this entire voir dire transcript, and there are a lot of things that struck me from that reading, both the sloppiness of both of counsel to the sloppiness of the state trial judge at the initial challenge of the 4 out of 5 when the prosecutor should have been put to her proof as to why she had taken those strikes. That wasn't done at all. But I certainly didn't. And what then comes through loud and clear to me anyway is that you had a tit-for-tat between these two counsel. First, there was the Batson challenge by the defense counsel, and then there was a palpably angry Batson challenge made farther down the line by the prosecutor.
That's correct. And if the defense attorney was engaged in reverse Batson discrimination, that's outrageous. But
it's not really relevant here.
It's not relevant, and it shouldn't inure to my client's detriment. But here's the important point. If I've convinced the court that the appellate division really applied what was a step 3 test instead of step 1, then we satisfied 2254D1, and you're allowed to review this de novo. And so
assuming that you're right in that, when I looked at the 5 witnesses for whom peremptories were used during the first day, I mean, any prosecutor worth their salt, and we've all been in situations where we see the transcript and the court itself these incredibly contrived examples come up for justifying striking a black juror. Any lawyer with his or herself can justify it. Here you've got a situation where, on the face of it, there are very valid reasons for striking each of these five folks, four of whom were black.
Well, we don't know if that was the prosecution's actual reasons, and until you call her, right,
But we do know that the judge, after hearing hers alone as the argument, and after hearing what each of these potential jurors said, said to himself, I'd not find an inference of discrimination from numbers alone. To me, that says, because I was a trial judge, I listened to this, and I see why a prosecutor would strike this person, so the numbers alone just aren't going to do it here. Now, had these people been, you know, wonderful as apple pie for the prosecution, you know, the judge might have said, doesn't cut it. But he observed, and that's why it's, I think that the standard is, you know, I think it's clear error. It's not de novo.
Well, but it's not clear error, Your Honor, because there was no finding made. Right? There's no step three finding. If there's a step three finding of no intent.
Well, there's no explicit step three finding. I don't know what to make of this analytically because it was so inadequately handled at the start, both by the trial court and by the prosecutor. But, I mean, how do you say that we ought to be looking at this? Should we be looking to this as purely a step one prima facie case issue, in which instance I ask what authority supports our determination that that 4 out of 5 is enough for a prima facie case, especially whereas here there was not a later objection or any kind of continuing objection.
Well, again, so it is a step one case only because the appellate division purported to reach only
step one. So that gets resolved as a question of law, right?
That's what we contend.
We don't have to get to step two where factual determinations are being made by a trial judge.
Right.
And inherent credibility determinations.
Right. We're hoping that's what will happen on remand, is that steps two and three will be completed.
So what is the authority that allows us to say there's been a prima facie case made here?
Johnson, right, which reversed the California Supreme Court and said there is a prima facie case here and sent it back. Is number one. Number two, I cited the Osorio case in my brief, which is a state case, but that's a case out of the same office tried at the same time in 2002 in which the first 6 strikes were exercised. And
let's say we determined there was a prima facie case. Then the next step is to get to step two. Why isn't it enough? Slim as it is, why isn't it enough for the prosecutor to say, well, I support this based on the answers that we all heard. And that's effectively what she said, right? That's what was said.
Well, she just said, I think if you look at the transcript, the record will bear out that I did not.
I think there was an explicit use of the word answers. But in any event, clearly, for the proceedings to have gone on, the trial court judge had to have made that as a factual determination, as a credibility determination, didn't he?
Right.
He had to have bought that excuse, slim as it was.
Chief Judge Smith, that's correct. But if once you require the prosecutor to provide reasons, then the defense attorney can look at what's gone on with people who haven't been excluded or people who have been left on the jury and
that's
say...
That's one of the problems with firing guns so early in the game, rather than waiting.
Agree.
How can we say as a matter of law that a trial judge who has observed the voir dire has observed the strikes and determines that numbers alone, the fact that there were 4 out of 5, is an inference of discrimination. How do we say as a matter of law that's not permissible?
How do we say that? Because
it's one thing to say that if a judge found numbers alone, that was fine. But how can we say he has to say that numbers alone satisfy Batson when he's observed and may have a view that that really doesn't raise an inference of discrimination.
Well, my answer to that question is because you're not reviewing the trial judge's decision here. You're reviewing the appellate division's decision. The appellate division has already found that the trial judge employed an erroneous standard, and so there's no value to what the trial judge said because he was holding the defense attorney's feet to the fire, imposing a much higher standard than Johnson now requires. So the question is, did the appellate division do it right? And when the appellate division says, you know, at least four things that tell you it was applying a Step 3 analysis, you know that the decision is contrary to Johnson and Strickland, and then the question is de novo, and you can look at the entire record.
All right, we'll have you back on rebuttal, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you for your generosity.
Mr. Duco.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Randy Duco from the Essex County Prosecutor's Office for appellees in this matter. I was going to begin by saying context is the most important word in the Darden claim, and Chief Judge Smith, you laid it out quite well. I don't need to do it again, but the prosecutor was required to say something. She could not leave that 80% identification is not enough. She couldn't just leave it hanging out there for the jury to consider. She had to give a response. She gave a fair and measured response tied to the evidence. And when you look at that response in the context of her entire summation, she doesn't just say 80% was enough. She says 80% coupled with the out-of-court identification made 5 days after the robbery was enough to meet beyond reasonable doubt.
So we know in the photo array was anybody hit the mugshots first.
Correct.
So we know was he the only person in the subsequent photo array with six photos whose picture was also in the mug book that was viewed? Do we know that?
I don't know that. I know the jury saw the six-person photo array and judged for themselves on that question, but I don't know if there was any overlap between those individuals and the ones in the mug books.
Forgetting the Darden issue for a second, I have a hard time reading what the lawyer said during the selection of the jurors in disagreeing with Mr. Sanders characterized. It is a characterization. It's not what the prosecutor said, but he said, look, I've got no objection to a majority African-American jury, but, the but's my thing, not the transcript, I would like a mixed jury. Basically saying, look, I got too many black folks here, and I've got a challenge. Judge, help me out here.
I disagree with that.
Well, how else can you interpret this? I have no objection to a mixed jury. He's got to say that. What's he going to say? Judge, I don't want too many black folks on my jury. He knows the president to say that, so he says, I have no objection to a majority African-American jury. I would like a mixed jury. Now, no matter which way you slice that, the prosecutor is saying that he is factoring race into the use of weapons. He's striking whites to get a mixed jury, or he's striking blacks to make sure that he doesn't have too many blacks on the jury.
No, I think her point simply was that under state law at the time, she had used up her peremptory challenges.
Right.
She could no longer exercise any peremptory challenges, and she was concerned that the defense attorney was using hers in an inappropriate way. There's a lot of there's a lot of spaces. It's not the most artfully commented.
Well, she says, I would like a mixed jury. She's clearly concerned, as unfortunately almost any prosecutor would be, about the racial composition of the jury. It's basically what she's saying. I want a mixed jury. I got to enjoy the African-American jury here.
Well, okay. It can't be ignored, and the cases say that can be considered is the fact that the victim was African-American as well in this case, so we don't really make a whole lot of sense why a prosecutor would want to exclude.
Don't get me going on that road. Don't get me going on that question. You're dead wrong on that.
And as was pointed out before, it's very difficult. There are cases where on numbers alone, a prima facie case can be found, but those numbers are usually much higher. The first 4 out of 5 of 12 strikes doesn't say a lot, and to the extent we don't.
All right, so, isn't that your strongest argument, or isn't that at least the argument you advance first and say, no, there's nothing to support this, the inquiry ends there?
Correct. All there are the numbers, and the numbers are meaningless in this case, honestly, because we don't know what the veneer is. And if you practice in Essex County, it's safe to bet those were not the only 4 African-Americans in that veneer. Now, the record doesn't bear that out, but common sense.
We don't know from the record.
We don't know that. That's fair. But
do we know, as a matter of fact, from the record, that a majority of the composition of the seated jury were African-American?
All we know on that question is at the conclusion of the third Batson challenge in this case, the prosecutor says at that time the majority were, but there were, I believe, a few more strikes, so it's not clear from the record.
How many strikes are there in Jersey, 12?
The prosecutor gets 12, the defendant gets 20 in a non-homicide.
The appellate division's conclusion that the ultimate composition of the jury made everything okay, is that really what they should be looking at?
Not at step one, no. And if you look at the appellate division...
So isn't that a problem that they actually deferred the trial judge? They said, on the issue of the prima facie case, but could they really revisit the issue under a different standard when the trial judge had used a higher standard? Is that really something that the appellate division could defer to the trial judge on its finding, but acknowledging that there was too high a standard?
Well, the appellate division would defer to the finding and then determine whether, as a matter of law, it reached the Johnson standard.
Yeah, it's just kind of strange that when the trial judge said it didn't meet this high bar, then the appellate division said, well, the bar is actually lower, but we'll defer to his finding that it didn't meet the high bar.
Correct, and if it was a close case, like it was in Johnson, maybe the appellate division would have did what the Supreme Court did there and found the prima facie case, but this was not a close case.
Well, the appellate division said there was no proof by the defense of an unfair or unreasonable underrepresentation of African Americans or women, but that wasn't the issue. There was no proof by the defense of a basis on which, the prosecution, should not have been striking these people.
Correct. Johnson lowers the burden, but it's still a burden. The defendant was still required to come forward with some evidence.
Yeah, but raises an inference versus substantial likelihood is really very different.
It is different.
Inference, kind of your antenna up. Substantially likelihood that was discriminatory is...
And that statement may be a good example of the difference. To me, that creates an inference. Doesn't raise the level of substantial likelihood, that being the...
Yeah. And the appellate division said this deference is in large part attributable to the fact the trial judge is able to make firsthand observations of the demeanor of the attorney exercising the challenge and the juror in question. But bearing in mind,
well, the first part of that is right. The second part obviously isn't, but the first part is right because the prosecutor said the juror's answers to the questions would show that there were non-race-based reasons.
Well, that gets us into step two, right? Isn't it? I mean,
that's step two, right?
I mean, so that would be my follow-up inquiry. Assuming that a prima facie case has been shown by the defense, in moving to step two, the exact words of the prosecutor were, it's clear from the answers that the jurors gave that are African-American that I have excluded form the basis of my decision and not because they are simply African-American. Sparse, I grant you, sparse, but are you suggesting that would still, at step two, be enough upon which a trial judge conducting voir dire can make a credibility determination, a factual determination, that these were, in fact, the reasons for taking these strikes?
Of course, and I do acknowledge Mr. Sanders' concern that, the defense attorney then didn't have an opportunity to rebut. The record makes clear and even you point out, Judge McKee, the reasons why those jurors were struck are fairly obvious and should be fairly obvious to this court. And you can look at that record and make that determination. So if we do get there, and back to Judge Rendell's point that the appellate division may have applied the wrong standard, that doesn't change the fact that there was still no prima facie case here. So even if this court looks at that question anew, there's still only the 4 out of 5 without knowing the veneer and nothing else. And that does not meet the prima facie standard. Unless the court has any other questions, I'm finished. Thank you.
No, thank you. Mr. Sanders, we'll be back in rebuttal.
Thank you. Let me pick up right where my adversary left off. And that is that the state has never argued that the trial court reached step two and then made a finding at step three, and that's what the appellate division was doing when they issued this sort of hybrid decision. You haven't made a prima facie case because you haven't proved discrimination.
Can we affirm on that basis? It's on the record.
I don't think so, because I think if this had gone the way it was supposed to go, right, with the prosecutor being required to set forth her reasons, then the defense attorney has something to argue. That's a pretext. Here's a reason why.
She did set forth her reasons.
Well, but the finding of the trial judge was that you haven't made a prima facie case, not that I haven't found discrimination. And I'd like to read, to go to Judge Rendell's point about the standard, what the court said in Johnson. And this is clear. I meant to say it earlier. We did not intend the first step to be so onerous that a defendant would have to persuade the judge on the basis of all the facts, some of which are impossible for the defendant to know with certainty, that the challenge was more likely than not the product of purposeful discrimination. In other words, you can't hamstring the defense attorney by saying you haven't proven to me discrimination yet when all the facts aren't out there. And because the trial court made a legal error and because the appellate division purported to correct it, but then itself made a legal error, this court now is entitled to, as the appellate division was trying to do, to look at the entirety of jury selection and decide whether the numbers plus the comment later is enough to give rise to an inference, and we respectfully submit that it is.
And you agree that the ultimate composition test, which the appellate division used and the district court used here as well, is not the test. Is that correct?
I agree with that. Not only is it not the test at step one, it shouldn't even be relevant at step three.
We said that in an NPO. We said that in Saunders. But what case sets forth that proposition?
Well, I think Batson says it because it says discrimination.
The problem here that this was raised under Gilmore and that the discussions were pursuant to Gilmore, which talks, I believe, about a cross-section, doesn't it?
It does.
So perhaps people were caught up in the whole cross-section notion without focusing, as they should have, on Batson and its requirements.
Right. It eventually turned into a Batson claim because under New Jersey law, sort of, if you raise one, you raise both. And there's been no argument here that there's been a procedural default or that this is an adequate and independent state ground.
Well, it would be relevant in a factual pattern where you wait and make your Batson challenge later, not one by one, not so early in the game. You make it later and you say, oh, no, I see there's six blacks on the jury, so I use that to help me to say there's no discrimination.
I mean, you could. I can see why circumstantially you would argue it's relevant, but it's very dangerous because it gives rise to this argument that it's okay if you discriminate against the first two African Americans or whatever group, minority group.
Is one strike a prima facie case? One strike of an African American in this setting, was that a prima facie case?
No.
In this
two.
Setting.
In this case.
With the prosecutor's statement, I would.
What if the juror said, I'm a law and order person, and I always vote with the government, and then the person's stricken?
Well, that's the issue. And some of these jurors had people, the first four who were struck had people in law enforcement who, as a former prosecutor, I was in AUSA for 10 years. That's exactly the kind of person I would want on my jury.
Also had robbery in there.
Yeah, and there's also a school of thought that the person the prosecutor wants least on a jury is the wife of a police officer. You can argue either way because she knows what he's like.
That's right. I see my time is up. May I make one final point regarding the Darden claim? Because, Judge McKee, you touched on something that I wanted to bring up, and that is, I stressed the weakness of the evidence, and you pointed out from going from the mug books to the photo array.
It's pathetic. The idea is pathetic here, but that's
and right. And I mean, it's odd that the Supreme Court of New Jersey, which is on the forefront of this issue, has made its Henderson ruling prospective. So the only way, Mr. Minor is going to get a fair shake at this and get a new trial under the revamped identification procedures is if he gets relief here. It's concerning that there was an ID of this type even after the Attorney General guidelines in 2001.
This came after the Attorney General guidelines?
It came after, but there was a violation of them, and notwithstanding that, his motion for a Wade hearing was denied.
And that wasn't raised, though, was it?
It was raised in the district court, and a certificate of appeal was denied on that issue, both in that court and this court. But the concerns about that identification, which I know you are well aware of, and the science on that, is what makes this Darden issue so concerning.
Mr. Sanders, are you retained counsel in this case?
No, we were appointed under this Criminal Justice Act.
All right. Well, we thank you very much.
Thank you for the appointment.
Thank you. Thank you very much, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement, and I think that ends the day for us. We'll adjourn the proceeding.
Leave.